Welcome to The Great Awakening. I'm your host, Josh Dawes. Today, my guest is Delano Squires. He is a research fellow at the Heritage Foundation and a contributor at Blaze Media, where he writes about faith, family, and culture. He also appears regularly on the Fearless with Jason Whitlock podcast, and you may have seen him on Relatable with Ali Beth Stuckey. His writings can be found in a variety of publications, from Newsweek to The American Conservative and The Federalist. He is an up-and-coming thinker on the right that is really, I think, going to do big things in the coming years. And I'm very grateful to have him on the show. He's a strong advocate for Christians expressing their faith in the public square. And he recently gave a talk at the National Conservatism Conference down in Miami. Thought it was a wonderful talk, so I invited him on the show and sat down with him a little bit ago to talk about it. So let's jump right into that conversation. Hey, Delano, thanks for joining me on the show.
Thanks for having me, Josh.
So you recently spoke at the National Conservatism Conference in Miami, NatCon. And when I saw the topic of your talk, which I believe was America's Prodigal Fathers, I assumed you were going to be talking about, you know, absentee fathers. And, you know, it's not an uncommon topic, you know, at conservative conferences to talk about the problem of, you know, dads that are just checked out and, you know, leaving moms to raise their kids on their own. But when I heard the talk, you very much... I feel like you diagnosed a much broader problem that really had me kind of like examining my own life. Like, where am I not showing up where I need to be? So can you talk to us? What do you mean by prodigal fathers?
Sure. So when I say prodigal fathers, I'm talking about men who I would say have wasted the gift of masculinity, that God-given gift. And, you know, it shows up in a number of different ways. And in the speech I talked about, let's say, you know, you're talking about men who have exited the workforce. So, you know, guys who spend more time playing video games than they do actually out earning a living. Men who no longer desire marriage or family. So these are guys who are not even fathers yet and don't want to be. Men who are physically absent from their families and have in one way or another abandoned both their children and the mothers of those children, and then also men who may be physically present, emotionally absent, right, in terms of that child-rearing process. And then guys in general, and this is not just fathers, but adult men who are absent on the front lines of the culture war. And one of the things I said is that for as much respect as I have for groups like Moms of Liberty, it shouldn't be up to women and children to really fight some of these battles. Mm-hmm. Guys should be standing up to defend both sort of in word and sometimes in deed, to defend their own family. So I framed my speech around the parable of the prodigal son. And one of the things I said is that when a son is prodigal, right, when a son engages in wasteful living and disappoints his parents, it does have an effect on parents, but it's a limited effect. But when a father is missing in action, everyone under his authority suffers. So both the women and the children, or the woman and the children, suffer. So it was one part information, one part admonishment, one part encouragement. And I hope that message came across.
Oh, it did, loud and clear. It was, I think I look in my own life, just in how many conversations I've had with dads who haven't even been in their child's classroom. Like they have just completely like checked out, and they've, you know, and in scripture that is a direct responsibility given to the father.
Yes.
You know, it's not, I think it's too many in the church kind of look at that as like, yeah, whatever the mom wants, you know, that's her realm. You know, I go out, I'm present. I'm here in the home. I'm providing. I'm not an absentee dad. But where the culture war is really raging right now, they're not there. Mm. They're not on the front lines. And Yeah, the line you said about the Moms for Liberty, as much as we love that group, it's a great organization. You know, where are the dads? And that's why do you think Christian men in particular are failing to show up?
I mean, I think it's a number of factors. Generally speaking, when people don't engage in some type of, you know, positive or productive behavior, more often than not, there's just a general sense of apathy. Sometimes people don't know. Some don't care. Some just have other things to do. You know, you get busy with work and life. But one of the things that I do think is important to your point is for men to be in those places. When my wife and I were looking for a school for our daughter, she's six. She's the oldest of our three kids. In DC, kids start preschool at three. So I was the one who did all the research on the schools. I had my spreadsheet and I had, you know, whole nine yards. And I started to notice that some of these schools were sort of inviting in, you know, Black Lives Matter through their curriculum. They engaged in the Black Lives Matter at school week, which is the first week in February. And I started to see how some of these schools would take on parts of the BLM curriculum and infuse them into the classroom. And so some of them did this proudly. They would display things on their social media accounts. And it was one of these things where I said, there's a lot going on in these classrooms, in these schools that parents are not aware of. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of books that they're not aware of. It wasn't my daughter's classroom. It was a different classroom in the school where, you know, where she was in after school, and they had A is for Activist. And that was probably for slightly older kids. But to me, it just gave me a sense of where the school was going. Mm-hmm. And then that February, which is February 2020, they rolled out, they had a chalkboard with the names, or no, it might've been a wall with the names and images of a bunch of people, Michael Brown, Trayvon Martin, for BLM at school week. And I emailed the principal and I said, like, what's the school's position on BLM? I didn't want to tip my hand, but he never responded to me. And she didn't go back to the school after the pandemic. Because to your point, education is given to parents as their responsibility, and specifically to fathers, mm-hmm. To bring up our children in the fear and admonition of the Lord. And I take that responsibility seriously. Now, we may delegate that responsibility, right? Husbands and wives together making decisions for their children may delegate that responsibility. But too many schools have gotten comfortable assuming that it's their responsibility and we're just allies, mm-hmm. Who just show up with the kids. And they sort of shoo us away. And sometimes they'll say, well, you can't come to the school during these hours. It's like, what are you talking about? These are my children, right? Mm-hmm. So it's that type of thing that I think people just need to be aware of. And sometimes some people just need a gentle shake, a gentle nudge and reminder to say, you know, this is your responsibility. But I think for other people, and I would count myself in this, let's say 6 years ago, it will require a transformation of the mind, a transformation of worldview. And particularly for Christians, that worldview should always be rooted in scripture.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, you know, it's concerning to me that there is such a lack of awareness. You know, I think many in the church evangelical world don't like the idea of culture war. And so I think there's this idea that that's something that happens out there and we shouldn't be involved in it. And there seems to be like a lack of awareness that the culture war is coming for you, whether you want it to or not. Mm-hmm. And specifically your kids. Like you were saying, like there, it's not just that they don't want parents meddling. A lot of times they feel an ownership over our kids. Oh, yeah. Like they have to intervene. Mm. And, you know, that's one of the things I'm trying to do with this podcast is help Christians really think through a lot of these issues and be aware of it. What questions do you think parents should be asking their schools?
That's a great question. And one, I'll say this, I absolutely agree with you in terms of Schools, school districts, elected officials, school boards have oftentimes set themselves up as a counter authority to our rightful parental authority, right? So it's not even mm-hmm. I go and I say, I own my kids. It's no, God created them and he gave them to me and my wife to steward and to shepherd. Again, we give them to you for you to act in loco parentis. But as I said before, mm-hmm. a lot of school districts take that Latin phrase and think that it's Spanish for these parents are crazy. So they think that they have the right to say, well, if this goes on in little Johnny's home, we don't like that. We don't allow that. So we will step in between him and his parents to guide him in a different direction. Mm-hmm. And I think that's both bad policy. And I think in the worst case scenario, that can be a breeding ground for all different types of abuse of one sort or another. But in terms of questions, I think parents, especially nowadays, I think off the top, parents should ask schools, how do you handle matters of race and ethnicity? And how do you handle matters of gender and sexuality? What is the school's official position on, you know, personal pronouns? What do teachers teach in terms of biology and anatomy? Does your school believe that there are more than two sexes? Does your school believe that men can get pregnant? These are all questions that I would ask. Does your school engage in quote unquote social transitioning of gender confused children? Right. I would ask all of these questions, and then have them, you know, provide a response on the record, because again, a lot of things are going on in the darkness. And I think parents just need to bring those things to the light and not be afraid of being called names, not be afraid of being called a bigot or saying that you're threatening teachers. Because mm-hmm. I would never advocate for, you know, physically threatening teachers or administrators. But I will say this, and particularly to men, even though, again, I wouldn't advocate for physical threats, I don't think there's anything wrong with teachers and administrators who say, you know what, I don't want to mess around with these dads, right? So if some of them have a little bit of the fear of God in them, good, they should, right? Because in the same way, and I'm going to make an analogy, it's not complete, but I think people understand what I'm saying. In the same way, a thief in Texas has a different assessment of risk than one in New York City, because he knows that in any household he goes to, there may be someone armed in there. Whereas in New York City, where I grew up, or a lot of other big cities, you say, oh, it's an easy target, right? No, nobody's armed. I'm the only person that's armed. And in the same way, I think schools do, and administrators do need a healthy dose of godly fear in their hearts, because they're messing around with people's children. And it's bad enough when they teach bad mm-hmm. things, but I've seen parents testify that schools went behind their back to help, again, quote unquote, transition their children. And when that type of thing happens, some furniture may need to get moved from time to time.
Yeah. I think one of the reasons why dads tend to leave this, leave their wives to fight these battles, is there's a very real fear of the consequences that might happen if they start pushing back on this. You know, a lot of men are working at, you know, companies where they're encouraged to, you know, celebrate Pride Month. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if they become an outspoken advocate against, you know, the gender ideology in schools, that could have very real consequences at their work.
Yeah.
And I think that's one thing I would encourage men. When you start asking these questions, you need to be prepared to weather the consequences.
Yeah.
And you need to shoulder that. That's not for your wives to shoulder. That's for you to shoulder as the you know, provider and the protector of your family. Mm-hmm. And so if you ask those questions of your school and you get answers that you're not comfortable with, mm-hmm. Okay, what are you prepared to do about it? What changes are you prepared to make in your life and your lifestyle to address those concerns?
Yeah.
Any advice? Yeah, go ahead.
No, I think you hit the nail on the head. I actually, over the last 2 years, I've gone through that exact same situation. Prior to coming to the Heritage Foundation, I worked for within DC government, local government, for over 14, nearly 15 years. All that time, during that time, I started to write publicly. First for a site called Black and Married with Kids that promoted more positive images of Black families. And then for The Rood and The Griot, which was fine, right? Nobody's going to bat an eyelash. But then when I started to write for The Federalist and The Blaze, I said, okay, there's a real possibility. Someone may call me and say, hey, so-and-so within the government is not pleased with what you're writing. And then when I started to appear, let's say on Tucker Carlson show or on, my regular appearances on Fearless with Jason Whitlock, I knew I was taking a calculated risk. I knew pushing back assertively against the left was a calculated risk. And I had to, count the cost. One of the things that we did, mm-hmm. we ended up doing is pulling our daughter out of that school. And, my wife and I decided that she would come home and we would educate our children at home. So we're going into our third year of homeschooling. And one of the things, Josh, I know you and the listeners would appreciate that is as a believer, I have found personally that as I become more obedient in my God-given role and my wife in hers, everyone in the household is flourishing. I'm not saying it's perfect, but our children are happy and content. They cause mischief because that's what kids do, right? But I feel like I've grown and grown stronger and said, I'm taking this responsibility on. I didn't always think this way. One of the things I've often said is if there is a national cultural movement to uproot feminism out of our structures and our systems and our policies and our cultural norms, it's going to be harder to get it out of some men than it will be some women, because all of us have been trained in this way. And many men nowadays think that a woman's primary contribution to her home is her paycheck, just like him. So I had to learn, I had to grow out of, that type of thinking. But I agree. Some guy's going to have to count up the cost. Some guy's going to have to take a second job, either pay for private school or to cover what may not be coming in if their wife leaves her job. Some family's just going to have to sacrifice certain things, pinch a few pennies.
Yeah.
But all of those things are worth it because our children are gifts from God. And, I think the stewarding them and shepherding them and discipling them is one of the mm-hmm. greatest responsibilities that parents will ever have.
Yeah. And I think it gets back to that kind of hierarchy of values that we get as we spend mm-hmm. time in God's mm-hmm. word and we let it shape what we find valuable, right? That, our kids' education is more important than that, third vacation that we like to take every year, or, whatever it is that is preventing you from making, the kind of changes that you really need to be faithful in the responsibilities God's given you. Mm-hmm. After I invited you to come on the show, you came out with a piece at the American Conservative talking about, I believe it, drag queen conservatism. Mm-hmm. Can you explain what that is and why you felt the need to address that, phenomenon that you're seeing?
Sure. So some of your listeners may have heard of the Christian, social cultural commentator, a gentleman named David French. And in recent years, David has been a very vocal critic of Donald Trump, President Trump, Trump administration, and evangelical Trump voters, who I think it's fair to say he believes have brought some manner of disrepute onto, the body. And one of the things that he did after the National Conservatism Conference was write an article saying that the push for a more religious and specifically Christian public square that was expressed at NatCon would ultimately lead to less religious freedom for all people. And I think, and one of the things he did, he went back to the well, he talked again about drag queens, and a couple years back, he referred to drag queen story hour as a blessing of liberty. So he talked about drag queens again, and he said, well, whose version of Christianity would dominate the public square? Because some churches host drag shows and other churches don't. There are other churches that are opposed. So one of the points I make in the piece is that any self-professed Christian who's not sure whether a church that's hosting drag queen shows is actually a Christian church has larger problems than trying to figure out the right role of religion in the public square. So when I say drag queen conservatism, I'm talking about that political philosophy that upholds personal freedom and individual liberty to such an extent that it becomes an idol because they detach it from an external, objective, transcendent source of morality, such that adults who want to do drag in front of kids in schools and libraries and in public spaces are said to be exercising their rights, and that the children who oftentimes, particularly in schools, are unconsenting, an unconsenting audience, they just have to deal with it because this is one of the things that happens in a free society. I reject that premise 1,000%. So I sort of paint that picture of what drag queen conservatism in terms of the political philosophy, but when I got down to the specifics, my point to French is that we already live in a thoroughly religious public square. It's just not Christianity. Mm-hmm. You mentioned it before, the fact that every June, everyone knows that every logo on social media is about to turn rainbow colors. You're about to be bombarded even more with advertisements for queer beer and Pride Night Out and LGBT representation on Nickelodeon and Disney. There's the indoctrination on gender ideology in our public schools, professional sports leagues, pride flags in the window of every other Starbucks, on federal buildings, on state buildings. So, I mean, our public square already has a religion. It's been queered. And people like David French don't want to acknowledge that. My only point is that, you know, every society has a closet, a range of beliefs and behaviors it believes are off limits for the public sphere. There was a time when Christians were able to live out loud and proud, you know, so to speak. And sexual activity was consigned to the private realm. Now that's reversed. And everything having to do with sexual activity is made public. And we as believers have been pushed into the closet, many of us cowering and trying to figure out the correct personal pronouns to use for our coworker who was recently transitioned. At the end, I just say, look, somebody's going in that closet, just a matter of who. And it's not big enough for both. And I would much rather have a public square that acknowledges God as creator, that acknowledges the inherent worth of all life, that says that marriage is a covenant relationship between one man and one woman for one lifetime, that children do best when they're raised by their married biological parents, that sexual activity should be confined to the public sphere, and that we do not want any representation, particularly aimed at children, that glorifies, same-sex relationships, transgenderism, if it glorifies a lifestyle that would lead people unable to reproduce, we don't want it in our public square. I would much prefer that type of culture than one that says, you know, do as you will. You know, teachers can engage in their kinks in your kid's classroom. And if you say something, you're the bad person. So that was, you know, the long and short of it. And I just think drag queen conservatism is a dead political philosophy.
Yeah, I think Dr. Moeller said it well at NatCon. He said there is no such thing as a neutral
secular state. Correct.
Secular state. Yep. It doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. There's always a religion,
right?
Like you said, and it strikes me as kind of ironic that the David Frenches of the world, as much as they want to accuse, you know, MAGA Republicans of, you know, pining for the 50s, mm-hmm. they're kind of LARPing the 50s and, you know, as if our elections are just about tax policy, right? And it really doesn't matter who wins. It's like, that hasn't been the case in a long time. We are very firmly in hostile world, to use Aaron Wren's framework. Mm-hmm. And I think it's time, you know, conservatives start waking up to that elections do matter. Absolutely. And they have enormous stakes right now.
Yeah.
We want to believe we live in a world where elections don't have stakes, and yeah, it's fine if we lose this one, we'll get it next time. They are enormous right now, and you know, we need to act like it.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things that I've noticed, particularly from as someone who's read David French for a number of years now, he seems to have difficulty or is reluctant to make certain types of moral judgments. And one of the things that I notice, and I'm very attuned to this, particularly within evangelicalism, there is a tendency for some white evangelicals specifically to not speak too firmly on certain issues because they believe that their black brothers and sisters have a different perspective on those issues, even if the white evangelicals I'm talking about think that clear reasoning from scripture would say that the quote unquote black position on these issues is wrong, mm-hmm. or sinful. And one of the reasons I say that is because, again, French, in his criticism of NatCon, before he got to the part where he said, you know, some churches host drag shows and others oppose them, he basically said, well, the Democratic Party's most loyal base is, you know, black Christians, and the Republicans' most loyal base are white evangelicals. Well, whose morality are you going to choose? And my position, my response would be the biblical version. And wherever that scripture tends to rest on any given issue, then go with that. But I think he has difficulty or is unwilling to make those judgments because to him, and I've seen this with a lot of people, it's like, oh, well.
Phil Vischer.
Phil Vischer, okay. So you understand what I'm saying. They'll say, oh, well, I can't say that because are you trying to say all those black Christians are wrong? It depends. What does the scripture say, right? If these same people would argue that white conservative evangelicals in the 50s were wrong on their stance on civil rights, right? Particularly ones who said churches and schools and everything should be segregated. So they acknowledge that a particular ethnic group, no particular ethnic group has a monopoly on biblical wisdom. And this is why, regardless of a person's ethnicity or sex or age or region or nationality, we all have to get clear on what is the ruler and what is the crooked stick. We have to know which one we're holding in our hands at any given time. So as I said, mm-hmm. when you put, and French did this in a subsequent article, the California law that says minors from other states can come and get sex change operations, quote unquote, without parental consent. And then the Texas, on the same moral plane as the Texas law that says parents who consent to sex change operations, quote unquote, for their kids are going to be, you know, liable for child abuse. Again, when those two things are on the same level, you're looking at someone who is no longer able to rightly divide the things that are going on in this world. And I think that's unfortunate.
Yeah. Well, I know we're coming up on time, and I want to be sensitive to your time. I do like to close with one final question.
Sure.
There's a lot of black pills in the world, mm-hmm. things to get, you know, despair over. What is giving you hope right now?
I'm sure it'll sound cliche on your show, but really, I mean, my faith has grown stronger by leaps and bounds over the last 5 years. And I would liken it to this. You can take a fairly low wattage bulb, and if you put it in a room and dim the lights low enough, it'll start to shine brighter and brighter. And for me, the faith that I had before, which, you know, has matured over the years, I had certain questions, right? I said, oh, well, dude, these people, they sound convincing when they say that the world is 65 trillion years old. Why wouldn't it be? You know, they say that they can create utopia if you just give the right people political power. That sounds good. And then I see people try to work these things out, and time again, they fail miserably. People who think they can control the weather with a stroke of a pen, or they can eradicate a virus, or, right? They laugh at Christians who believe in a six-day creation story, but they can't explain nature's nature, right? How do you, if you believe that humanity started from some single-cell organism and, you know, evolution produced X, Y, and Z, how do you explain the fact that men and women's bodies fit perfectly together in a way that propagates the species? Good luck. I mean, at a certain point, billions and billions of years takes a larger leap of faith, so to speak, than believing in God the Creator. So yeah. So my faith really does give me hope. It motivates me. And then on a personal, practical level, my family, one of the things that's a guardrail for me and a reminder to never speak a single word that I don't truly believe is because I value the respect of my wife. And my wife, of all people, would know if I was lying in public. And if I was out there saying, no, I believe that trans women are women, as soon as I get home, she would say, no, you don't. I know you. I know you don't believe that. So why would you say that? And also, you know, I want my kids to respect me. And I can't, they're young now, but at some point they're going to get to the age where they're going to have to make difficult decisions and not follow the crowd. And if I can't even give them an example of how to do that effectively without compromising your witness, then what chance do they have? So that's the really big thing. And then again, those practical things that give me hope.
That's great. Yeah. I was talking with my son, my oldest, he's 13, about to turn 14 last night. And I said, you were coming on the show and I was trying to, you know, explain who you are and the whole drag queen conservatism thing to a 14-year-old. And he just like was like, why can't people see that that's wrong? Like, I don't understand. And I got to talk with him about, you know, how, you know, easy it is to go along with culture. And, you know, Edmund Burke's quote that, you know, the only thing necessary for evil to triumph is for good men to do nothing. Right. And that, you know, we were raising him with a biblical worldview and, you know, pouring into him so that he would one day be a good man standing out there, you know, in the public square, you know, pushing back against this stuff. And I'm thankful for guys like you that I can point him to and say, there's a good man that's doing, you know, doing what, you know, God's called all men to do. So I thank you for your work, and I wish you all the best.
Thank you.
Where can people find you?
Probably the easiest way for them to find me is on Twitter. I try to keep myself out of trouble to varying degrees of success. my handle is @Delano, DELANO, Squires, SQUIRES, all one string, the one and only, which again, when I was working for DC government, made it hard for me to hide because when you Google my names, it's kind of bound to come up. But yeah, they can find me there. Same handle on Instagram, but I tend to do a lot of my social commentary on Twitter. And
awesome.
Well, I appear twice a week on Fearless with Jason Whitlock, typically Tuesday and Friday. And I write twice a week for The Blaze as well.
Excellent. Well, Delano, thank you. It's been a delight talking to you.
Thank you, Josh.
That's our show for today. Big thanks to Delano Squires for joining me for this conversation. You will find links in the show notes to the article we discussed, as well as his talk at NatCon. Definitely go and check those out. Give him a follow at Twitter. He's definitely someone you want to be paying attention to. If you found this content helpful, please share it with a friend. Ratings and reviews at Apple Podcasts are helpful for expanding the reach of the show, as well as if you're watching on YouTube, go ahead and hit like and subscribe. If you're listening, go ahead, head over to YouTube and subscribe so we can get the reach of the show out there to more people. As always, I am available at Twitter, at Josh Dawes. My DMs are open. I love interacting with listeners, so go ahead and send me a message over there, and I will do my best to respond. Let me know if you have any suggestions for future guests or any questions, anything you'd like me to talk about, and I will be happy to interact with that. Until next time, keep fighting the good fight.